From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Terrorism, civil rights, and the no-fly list. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The updated version of Al-Qaeda's underwear bomb has refocused attention on the no-fly list kept by the FBI since 2003. It includes some 500 American citizens who can't find out why they're on the list or how to get off it. We'll talk to a former Marine. Like 14 others who've gone to court, he says he has no terrorist ties and that the FBI won't confront him with evidence or tell him how to appeal. Is airborne terrorism so dangerous that it justifies suspension of constitutional rights? On Reporter's Notebook later on, criminal charges in Britain's phone hacking and corruption scandal. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. 500 American citizens are on the FBI's no-fly list without explanation or any way to appeal. We'll hear about the denial of constitutional rights and the latest in high-tech terrorist technology. On Reporter's Notebook, for the first time, British prosecutors have made criminal charges against one of Rupert Murdoch's former high executives and close confidants. We'll hear about that. First, this news update. Another apology today from Jamie Dimon, the man once known as Wall Street's smartest banker, this time at a meeting of J.P. Morgan Chase shareholders. He's apologizing, of course, for the now infamous $2 billion trading loss that he calls self-inflicted.
There are many lessons here and many changes in policy and procedures that are already being implemented. In addition, all corrective action will be taken as necessary.
Ben White is economics reporter for Politico. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
By corrective action, what do you suppose he means?
Collective action taken to remedy the problem. Well, we've seen, you know, three executives already on their way out. Excuse me, there'll probably be more. The big question, I think, is whether they're going to try to do clawbacks, which is to get some of the compensation back from the people responsible for these trades, particularly Ina Drew, who ran the unit that is responsible for the $2 billion loss that could actually be larger than $2 billion, earned something like $14 million last year. In the wake of the financial crisis, a lot of firms put in policies that allow them to get some of that money back for trades that go bad. And this would seem to be the perfect opportunity for them to put some money where their mouth is and actually go back and get some of this money back.
On the other hand, the shareholders today, after Dimon made his public apology, approved his $23 million pay package. What does that tell us about the efforts, at least on the part of the shareholders, to set things right?
Yeah, well, it tells us that there's a lot of residual love for Jamie Dimon, and not for bad reasons. I mean, J.P. Morgan, up until this point, had been the strongest performing bank in the United States, had done very well, had come through the financial crisis in much better shape than others. So I think maybe shareholders haven't quite swallowed the full impact of this loss yet and are still kind of pleased with his performance leading up to this point. Big shareholders have not shown a lot of anger over this and think that J.P. Morgan's still going to turn in a quarterly profit and they can get through this. But I think we're still too close to it to really get the full sense for what the ramifications of this are going to be. I think there's going to be a higher price paid, within J.P. Morgan and perhaps for Jamie Dimon than we've seen yet. So I wouldn't write this thing off as finished just based on the shareholder votes today.
There is a lot of evidence that Jamie Dimon, by his own indication, had some voice in approving those trades.
Yeah, well, I mean, the question is, to what extent did he know what this unit was up to? And there are reports suggesting that he was very much in favor of turning this chief investment office unit into essentially a hedge fund within J.P. Morgan. It's supposed to be something that they use to offset their risk as a hedging unit, but these kinds of trades don't look like that. They don't look like hedging trades. They look like trying to make a lot of money for J.P. Morgan, which this unit did over a series of quarters, produced very large profits. So what exactly was this? Was it a hedging unit, or was it basically an internal hedge fund used for proprietary trading? And if it was that, and it looks like it probably was, there's simply no way it could operate that way without the full knowledge of the chief executive officer. So I think it's just not We have not got a full accounting of what Jamie Dimon knew about this and what he did with it. So I think we'll learn a lot more in the coming weeks and months.
Speaking of chief executives, it's been reported by the New York Times, at least it was at one point, that Jamie Dimon was Barack Obama's favorite banker. What's happened to their relationship?
It's cooled off significantly. I think there's two pieces to that. I think it was overhyped to begin with, the closeness of their relationship. They knew each other. They had met each other in Chicago in 2004. Jamie Dimon was the chief executive of Bank One, which J.P. Morgan later acquired, and Barack Obama was running for Senate. They met. He contributed to his campaign. He was supportive of him. Jamie's a longtime Democrat, a lifetime Democrat from Queens, has been very supportive of Democratic candidates. But they were never, you know, close buddies. They didn't hang out together. They didn't do crossword puzzles together or anything like that. He was supportive of him, and, you know, when the financial crisis happened and Obama took over, he did, you know, reach out to Jamie for counsel, and they were friendly with one another. But they were not all that tight. And then when financial reform came around and Obama started talking about fat cats on Wall Street and raising taxes and adding regulations, Jamie Dimon really kind of backed away from that and has said some critical things about the president and the administration. So they were never all that close, and they're certainly not close now.
According to your story today in Politico, that Dimon now calls himself barely a Democrat.
Right. I think he said that on Meet the Press, and he is unhappy with what he believes is the demonification of the business community and, you know, sort of scapegoating people, and believes that the administration has put in some anti-business policies and doesn't like the rhetoric. I mean, he still says, you know, I support the principles of the Democratic Party, fairness and taxation and taking care of the neediest, those sorts of things. But he doesn't think the Democratic Party is good for corporate America and business. So he's sort of had a falling out. I wouldn't say he's Republican. I mean, I think barely Democrat is probably an accurate description of where he is right now.
And very, very quickly, the president's Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner says the SEC, the Fed are going to take a careful look. The FBI apparently is taking a look at this. So obviously the Obama administration is separating itself from J.P. Morgan Chase.
Yeah, and there are going to be multiple probes, and there should be. The question is, you know, were disclosures to shareholders accurate in terms of the risk that was being taken and what J.P. Morgan was doing in this particular unit? And you're right. There's no way that the administration can be closely tied up with J.P. Morgan at this point. I mean, Obama did have nice things to say about Jamie Dimon on The View, but you're going to see multiple federal probes of J.P. Morgan and the administration distancing itself.
Ben White of Politico, as always, thank you. In a moment, terrorism, civil rights, and the no-fly list on To The Point.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're only back with To The Point. The latest version of Al-Qaeda's underwear bomb revealed technology that could defeat airport scanners maintained by the TSA. We'll have more on that later. In the meantime, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is hearing a constitutional challenge to the government's no-fly list. One of the plaintiffs is Ibrahim Abe Mashal, a 4-year veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps. He's now a traveling dog trainer who discovered that he was on the no-fly list when he tried to check into a flight from Chicago to Spokane, Washington. Abe, good to have you on our program.
Hey, thank you, sir. Thanks for having me.
The first problem came the night before when you tried to check in on the Internet, I take it.
Yes, I went to print my boarding pass and was unable to do so.
And what happened after that?
Well, I called up Southwest Airlines, and you know, I informed them, hey, you know, I've never had trouble flying in the past. Me and my family have been all over. And they told me to check in with the ticket counter the next morning at the airport. So next morning, I got dropped off at the airport. I went in, went up to the ticket counter to check in, gave the lady my license, and she kind of gave me a strange look, and then she went in the back room for about 5 minutes with my license. So that was definitely strange. I was like, okay, what's going on? When she came back out, I turned around, and I was surrounded by probably at least 30 TSA and Chicago police, and she then informed me that I was on the no-fly list. I wouldn't be able to fly commercial aircraft, and that the FBI was on their way to the airport because they would like to speak to me. So, I mean, this was obviously a very huge shock. I kind of expected Ashton Kutcher to jump out and tell me I was being punked. I mean, it was just insane. And then a few minutes later, the FBI did show up. They were very polite to me, you know, shook my hand and asked if I minded going in a back room to answer some questions. And I did, because I figured this was just some mix-up, and I wanted to get it cleared up as quickly as possible. And when I went in the back room, it was just general questions. You know, what's my name, my date of birth, social security number, you know, and then he did get into some religious questions. And once he found out I was Muslim, you know, he got into a few more questions, but it was a very short interview. It only lasted about 15 minutes. And then he told me I was free to leave, but there was nothing I could do today to fly. So I said, well, wait, you know, before I leave, can I ask you a few questions? And he's like, oh, yeah, sure. And I said, well, how did I end up on this list, and what do I do to get off of it? And he told me that even if he knew why I was on the list, he wouldn't be able to tell me, and he knows of no way off of it. I could fill out a redress form on the Department of Homeland Security's website, but that could take forever, and who knows when you end up getting off of it, and they never tell you if you're on it or off of it. So I had no answers. It was both shocking and frustrating at the same time. Anyways, I got home that day a few hours later, and I went onto the DHS website, filled out the redress form, and not long after I filled the form out, this was just coincidence, the FBI ended up calling my cell phone, and they basically said on the phone, hey, Abe, you know, this is Agent so-and-so. We're 3.2 miles from your house. Are you home? I was like, yeah, I'm home. And they said, well, would you mind just stopping by? And I said, no, no problem. So they came by. They came upstairs. There was two different agents. And this was a bigger questioning that lasted over an hour. And it was kind of a strange thing because they actually pulled out a do-not-fly question and answer sheet and went down the sheet, which I thought was strange because, I mean, it's, you think of the FBI not working off cheat sheets. It just seemed like something, you know, a kid would use or something in an investigation. And then once they found out that I was a former military, they pulled out an additional sheet for, like, military, which was kind of a kick in the groin there because it's like, you know, I was in the Marine Corps. I was in the United States military, you know. And then as they went through the questioning and they found out I was Muslim, they asked me strictly questions that had to do with that faith. My mom is actually Catholic Italian, and they didn't ask anything about that. And that questioning lasted, like I said, a little bit over an hour, and that was it. They, you know, they told me thanks for my time, and they left. The next day, my client from Spokane called me, who I'd never met. I had been hired to go up there and train her dog, which was common for me. I am a traveling dog trainer, because that's what I did in the Marine Corps. I was a canine handler, and told me that the FBI had been to her house and asked questions about me, which I was like, wow, you know, now they're interfering with my business. This is unacceptable. So I called the agent back, and I said, you know, what's going on? And he apologized. He said, but they needed to verify my story. But, you know, at the same time, I'd been, you know, working and growing my business for 9 years since I've been out of the service. And, you know, it was like they were kind of screwing it up. So I was pretty upset by that. Anyways, that was in April 2010, and I didn't hear anything for 2 months. Then finally, in June of 2010, I got a call back from those federal agents, and they said, hey, Abe, we got great news to you about the no-fly list. And I said, okay, what is it? He says, well, you know, we don't really want to talk about it over the phone. Would you mind meeting again? I said, no, fine, come over. And they said they would rather meet somewhere closer to their field office, which is in the city of Chicago, and I'm about 40 miles west of the city. I said, you know, fine, where do you guys want to meet? And they wanted to meet at a hotel about halfway in between, and they told me that they would, you know, buy me something to drink and eat, and we would sit down and they could answer all my questions. So, you know, I was a little skeptical. It's like, why are they wasting their time wanting to meet with me if, you know, they could just tell me I'm off the no-fly list over the phone and be done with this whole issue. But anyways, I met with them. I went to the hotel that day, and I was under the impression that we were going to meet in the lobby. But then when I got there, I didn't see anybody, so I called the agent on his phone, and he came down from the elevator and actually told me he wanted to go upstairs to a fourth-floor room and talk about things up there. So right away, the whole thing took a strange twist because now I'm going to a private room at a private hotel with two federal agents. And when they got up to the room with me, you know, I went in there. They had, like, donuts and coffee. It was like a little stakeout. And they said, Abe, you know, we do have great news for you. We can get you off of the no-fly list, but you'd have to do something for us. I said, well, what do you guys need? And he said, well, we want you to go undercover as an informant for us and tell us about various people at various places and various mosques in the area. And at that point, you know, the conversation was a little bit longer than that, but I told him I'm no longer comfortable speaking without a lawyer present. And they told me that I had to leave after that. So I got home that day. You know, my wife was really shocked by everything. And, you know, my friends and family were, too. And that's when I kind of Googled the no-fly list because it's like, you know, where do I start? This is a secret list. It's not like I can just call up an attorney and, you know, they're going to represent me. And the ACLU cases came up, and that's when I contacted the ACLU. They sent a lawyer a few days later, and I sat down with her face-to-face, told her my whole story, and they added me to the lawsuit that was just getting started with all these other people finding themselves in similar situations as me.
Okay, we're talking with Abe Marshall. Again, he is a former Marine, a Muslim American citizen. He's also author of a book called No Spy, No Fly. And let me just ask you a couple of more questions. Had you been flying regularly in your dog training business for 9 years since you got out of the Marines until this happened in 2010?
Yes, both business and personally. We went to Disney. We went to Rhode Island. You know, I've been to Arizona a bunch of times. So I never, Las Vegas, never had one problem. I was never even selected for additional screening ever. And I just, I would always have an easy time at the airport.
What about your Marine service? Were you overseas?
No, I've never been overseas. I was served my time at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina.
Okay, again, Abe Marshall, one of the plaintiffs in a case being brought by the ACLU. Stay with us, if you will. I would like to come back to you later in the program. Hina Shumsi is an attorney in the no-fly list case, and she is director of the ACLU's National Security Project. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Is this a typical story?
Well, it is a story typical of the clients that we have in our lawsuit, 14 people in addition to Abe. And our lawsuit was filed because we believe it is un-American and unconstitutional for the government to put people on a watch list without any process that allows them to challenge their placement and to get off. The Constitution requires the government to give people, Americans, a reasonable chance to defend themselves after they've been denied their right to travel, just like Abe was.
Is it typical that they have been flying, the 14 others, all of whom are also Muslims, as I understand it, is it typical for them to have been flying normally, as he describes he was, for 9 years, and then all of a sudden find themselves on the no-fly list?
Yeah. Many of our clients had traveled regularly, and yes, they found out that they were on the no-fly list only when they got to airport. Some of them were outside of the United States. They were exiled abroad as a result, and only to find out that they were actually on the no-fly list and had no ability to be able to figure out why they were on the list and what process they should be able to use that was meaningful that would allow them to get off the list. You raised the question of, you know, our clients being Muslim, and it's true that all of the clients in this case are Muslim. Most of the calls we get about being put on the no-fly list are from Muslims, but not all. It's no surprise, though, that the kind of innuendo that's likely to land someone on the no-fly list will disproportionately impact members of the Muslim community. In a separate context, we found at the ACLU that the FBI's investigation authority is being used disproportionately against Muslims, American Muslims, in a form of crude racial and religious profiling such that people's names end up in FBI intelligence files after they innocently discuss with the FBI their First Amendment-protected religious beliefs and activities.
How did you find that out, and what do you mean by disproportionate?
Well, the FBI has a broader set of authorities that were put in place since 2001 that permits them to investigate people without an actual reasonable basis to believe that they've engaged in wrongdoing. And that's where a parallel can be drawn to the no-fly list here, because the no-fly list is part of the FBI's system where it set up what's called the terrorist screening database, which contains the names of tens of thousands of people, including thousands of Americans. And that list is administered by something that most people don't know about. It's called the FBI's Terrorist Screening Center. And the Terrorist Screening Center uses criteria that we do not know about to place people on watch lists and on the no-fly lists, and does not provide an adequate process for people to be able to challenge their placement or to be able to get off the list. And in our lawsuit, we sued the Terrorist Screening Center. The government argued that we should have instead sued the TSA, which people are more familiar with, Transportation Screening Security Administration. But the problem here, and the court agreed, a lower court agreed with the government, our case was dismissed. We were in court on Friday in Portland, Oregon, asking the Ninth Circuit to reinstate the case. And what we argued to the Ninth Circuit is that the TSA does not make the decision to put people on watch lists, nor does it make the decision to take them off. That decision is made by the entity that we properly sued, which is the Terrorist Screening Center. And, you know, we won't have a decision probably for another couple of months, if that. But I think one of the things that was very instructive was that the judges were clearly troubled about the existence of a watchlist system that doesn't tell Americans how they got there and what they can do to get off of it and the impact that it can have on people's lives to be put in a government black hole and not permitted to travel. In our modern life, people travel to visit family, to observe religious occasions together, travel for work just the way that Abe does. And when they are denied the ability to travel for reasons that they do not know, with a process that they cannot meaningfully use to challenge, that's when the constitutional right kicks in and why we have argued that the existing process violates the Constitution, our client's right to due process, and we've asked the court to order the government to remove our clients from the list or to provide a meaningful process that allows them to know the reasons they're on the list and a meaningful opportunity to challenge their inclusion so that they can get off it.
Again, Hina Shumsi is the one of the attorneys in the no-fly case that we heard about earlier and director of the ACLU's National Security Project. Paul Rosenzweig was Deputy Assistant Secretary for Policy in the Department of Homeland Security during the most recent Bush administration. He now consults in Washington on national security and privacy law. He's a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. Welcome to you, Paul Rosenzweig.
Thanks for having me.
Does this make any sense?
In a lot of ways, yes. I mean, obviously, I can't speak to the particulars of any individual's case, it is almost certain that, as with any human endeavor, there will be mistakes. It sounds like your first guess may have been the subject of one, but in the broad sense, of course, the use of a no-fly and a selectee list for airplanes makes sense. We've learned since 9/11 that, for reasons that are totally unclear to me, but are very clear to the terrorists, they're fixated on aviation as an area of attack, to the exclusion of almost every other type of transportation system. Most recently, the plot that was thwarted just last month, and so it makes perfectly good sense to manage a system that attempts to screen people who are going to be flying. I mean, in the broad sense, yes.
I want to ask you about whether it makes sense to do this without telling people in any way why they are on the list or giving them any opportunity to demonstrate that they ought not to be, to appeal the case, as we heard from Ms. Shumsi of the ACLU. But we don't have time before our break. We need to take a very quick break, and we're going to do that now. We'll come back to you, Paul Rosenzweig. We'll talk to others as well, and we'll hear more about the case you just mentioned, the latest version of the so-called underwear bomb, when we come back. Later on Reporter's Notebook, we'll talk about criminal charges in Britain's phone hacking scandal, people very close to Rupert Murdoch now charged with criminal offenses in Britain. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Subscribe to the To the Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To the Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, a hearing today about American citizens, many of Muslim religion, being put on a no-fly list by the FBI, the so-called Terrorist Screening Center, even after years of normal flying for various reasons, business and pleasure as well. And without being told why, and without having any kind of opportunity to protest or see if they can get off in any way. We're talking now with Paul Rosenzweig, who formerly worked with the Department of Homeland Security during the recent Bush administration. So let me put that question to you. Does it make sense to allow this to go on, not only without telling the people on the list why they're suddenly on it after years of being able to fly normally, and why there's no mechanism for helping them get off if, in fact, they're on by mistake? You indicated you thought our first guest, Abe Mashal, might have been put there by a mistake.
Well, let me add, there are two questions there, and I disagree with the premise that there's no process. But as to the first, as to why this is there's not full transparency into the process. I can't say it any better than the Washington Post said it in an editorial back in 2010. They said there are legitimate law enforcement reasons for keeping the list secret. Disclosure of such information would tip off known or suspected terrorists, whether or not they're on it, who could then change their habits or identities to escape government scrutiny. To publish the list would be essentially, besides disclosing sources and methods within the government, would be a roadmap of who isn't on the list that would make it easy for terrorists to say, oh, I'm not on it, I can do this. Now, that's the first piece. There's ample good reason for generally keeping the list secret, and there's absolutely no reason I could see for broadly publishing it. As for the process, there is a process. The ACLU just doesn't like it, right? There's an appeal process within the Department of Homeland Security through the Traveler Redress Inquiry Program, and if you don't like that answer, you can appeal to the District of Columbia Court of Appeals for a hearing on it, right? Now, that doesn't mean that they get to confront the evidence that is in the database for the reasons we've just talked about, but there's a process. What they don't like is the fact that they don't get to challenge it. They don't get to force the government to expose the evidence in open court, and for the reasons I said in the first part of the answer, I think that's the right decision fundamentally. It means, of course, that there's going to be some compromises in an adversarial process, but we do that all the time when we're talking about classified information. We do that all the time, and you know, that's the optimum balance, I think, between trying to find a way to make flights secure and afford people an opportunity to get off the list. That doesn't mean I'm insensitive to Abe's problem. I have a great deal of sympathy for him, indeed, and I probably wouldn't have take it with nearly the equanimity he does. But at the same time, there's a broader need here that also weighs in the balance, and you can't just throw that overboard.
Tell me the name of the organization you say that can be appealed to.
It's the Department of Homeland Security runs a program called the TRIP program, the Traveler Redress Inquiry Program. I think Abe said that he applied to it. I'm not sure because he wasn't exactly clear in my mind what he'd apply to, but that's the, and if you get an adverse decision from them, there's a mechanism for appealing to the D.C. Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. The ACLU wants to bring its suit in Portland, probably because it thinks it'll get a better answer from the Ninth Circuit.
Let me go back to Abe Mashal, again, our former Marine dog trainer, been traveling for 9 years by plane, suddenly was told he was on the no-fly list. Did you go, Abe, to the Traveler Redress Inquiry Board?
Yes, I did. I mean, you know, we all did. All the plaintiffs on the case did, and it took them 9 months to respond to my trip form because there's really no time limit. And their response was not yes or no. It just says that we are not able to disclose if you're on or off the list anymore. I mean, to me, it was a total joke because it doesn't tell you if you're on it or off of it for the reasons that your previous guest, you know, just described. And, you know, just to kind of go back to that point, I think that the secret lists and everything else, you know, they're totally against the Constitution. Everything he said sounds to me more like, you know, a Gestapo. That a Nazi than somebody who says that in America. I mean, as an American citizen, as a former Marine, I have the Bill of Rights right in front of me. You know what I mean? Are we following the Bill of Rights? Or are we going to live, you know, through fear all the time and fear mongering? I mean, there's thousands like mine.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Ted Kennedy was on the no fly list. Nelson Mandela was on the no fly list. I mean, when does it end? I mean, you know, so for him to say those things, I'm totally in disagreement with them. And, you know, there's other people that are like that. That's why I wrote the book and everything else. I want people to be aware that the system is broken and it doesn't work. That trip form does not work.
Okay.
I've been through it, and I've been up and down it. It does not work.
The book, again, by Abe Mashal, No Spy, No Fly. Paul Rosenzweig, back to you. What about the fact that pointed out by Ms. Shumsey from the ACLU that, in fact, although the Traveler Redress Inquiry mechanism is within the Department of Homeland Security, that's not the agency that puts you on the list. It's the FBI.
Well, I mean, that's actually wrong. In terms of the no-fly list, that's administered by TSA. The FBI administers the terrorism data screening, terrorism screening database, of which the no-fly list and the selectee list are subsets. Those lists are officially adopted by and issued as final orders by the Transportation Security Administration, which is why Congress has provided for review of orders under those lists by the D.C. Court of Appeals. I'm reluctant to respond, but I have to say it isn't a Gestapo tactic. The Constitution has provisions for secrecy written into it, including Congress's ability to make its proceedings secret. The Constitutional Convention that wrote the Constitution was conducted in secret. That's not a justification for secrecy in all instances, but it's an expression of the reality that sometimes secrecy is an important value in itself because it actually enables liberty.
Hina Shumsi of the ACLU, what's your response to Mr. Rosenzweig's contention that you just don't like this procedure and you're looking for a more favorable court by going to Portland, which is under the jurisdiction of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, rather than going to the Court of Appeals in Washington?
Well, it's true that we don't like the procedure, but the reason that we are in Portland is because we have clients there, and we are able to sue in Portland as a result of that. Let me just correct a couple of statements there. One, with respect to disclosure, let's be very clear here. People are tipped off that they are on the no-fly list when, like Abe, they are surrounded by any number of law enforcement personnel at an airport with hundreds of their fellow passengers around them and told that they cannot fly because they are on the no-fly list. That disclosure is made. Once that disclosure is made, there is no basis for depriving people of a fair process that allows them to get off the list. And so let's talk a little bit about the process. First of all, in our lawsuit, the government itself has filed court papers that acknowledge that it is the Transportation Security the TSC that is responsible for the no-fly list and for making decisions about who gets on and off.
You mean
of that
the FBI list. Organization?
Yes, the FBI's organization, the Terrorist Screening Center, that's right. But that is not a function that belongs to the TSA. The TSA, in essence, serves as a messenger. And Congress told the executive branch that there has to be a redress process for people who've been put on these kinds of lists, on the no-fly list. And what the agencies came up with is, quite frankly, a farce. Right now, if you're on the no-fly list, all you can do is go to a TSA website to fill out a form, but the inquiry isn't to the government agency that puts you on the list. It's to a government agency that doesn't have the power to take you off of it. And what you get back in response, what our clients have all gotten back, is a form letter in which the government says, we can't confirm or deny whether you're on the list, and if we're required to take any action, well, we've taken it, but we can't tell you what we've done, why you're on the list. We're providing you no opportunity to confront the evidence against you, and it doesn't say how the government has resolved the complaint.
Well,
it doesn't also say whether you can fly.
Mr. Rosenzweig, back to you. What about the fact that the disclosure's already been made once you're surrounded in public at the airport by all these agents? And number two, what sense does it make to appeal to an agency that can't take you off the list at all?
Well, nobody's suggesting that Abe doesn't know that he's on the list. I assume that he does.
So do a lot of other people who were there at the time.
But the reasons why are that's what she wants to challenge. I mean, if she wanted to challenge the assertion he is on the list or he is not, we wouldn't be having this discussion. That's well known and that's not disputed. The question that I don't know the answer to is why he's on the list. Is it a case of misidentification? That's what I assume. I don't know. Is there something else about this that we don't know? I do not know. What I do know is that the vetting process for putting people on the list requires both a nomination by an agency and a vetting within the TSC. There are standards that relate to the fidelity of the information, the grounds on which is based, and that to be on the no-fly list, there has to be substantial evidence within the government's possession that raises a reasonable suspicion of connection to terrorist activity. Now, Abe says that's not him. I believe him. But that's not It's not always the case. In fact, most of the time, it's the opposite. There is indeed substantial evidence.
And but doesn't he have he have a constitutional right if, in fact, you believe that he's on the list incorrectly, or shouldn't he have a constitutional right?
He has a constitutional right to due process, and sometimes the due process involves proceedings that involve in camera, where the judge makes a determination without him seeing the evidence. We've had things like that. All the time, we have an entire set of laws that relates to that. It more indeed, you know, you will often have a chance not to confront evidence against you when you're not being charged with a crime in terms of search warrants, issuance of grand jury subpoenas. Lots of things in the government's activities happen behind closed doors for good reasons, to protect informants, to protect sources and methods. You know, I'm not trying to defend the result in Abe's case. I'm sure that he's got a good claim that it's wrong. But as a general matter, the idea that the government has to be completely transparent and that everything needs to be exposed is just inconsistent with 220 years of history.
Okay. I promised at the outside of the program that we would talk a bit about the latest example of underwear bombs, and waiting patiently throughout this program is Bruce Hoffman, distinguished fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, director of the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University. Familiar voice on our program. And Bruce Hoffman, as always, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Just very quickly, when you have this kind of dispute going on, and when you have someone like Abe Mashal, who Mr. Rosenzweig suggests maybe have been treated unjustly, what does that do to the whole question of our effort to defend against terrorism?
I think it's always going to be a matter of balancing the fundamental civil rights and civil liberties of American citizens and others against giving those who are charged with our protection and defense the tools that they need to do so. I think the problem is that this is an evolutionary or very dynamic process, and that what we've seen with the latest iteration of the so-called underwear bomb is that our adversaries, firstly, rather than having been killed off or gone away, are still there, and moreover, they're still determined to target us, and specifically to target commercial aviation.
What about this particular device? What can you tell us that's different from the one that didn't go off over Detroit? Do you find it one that is sufficiently worrisome that we ought to redouble our efforts?
Well, I think we always have to be careful about redoubling our efforts and even increasing our efforts, because I think the experience of the past decade is what everyone's found, is that once we put these processes and procedures into place, they're very difficult to remove. So we have to do them. We have to put them in place, I think, very soberly and after considerable deliberation. What's so worrisome about the latest iteration of the underwear bomb is, I suppose one could really put it down to the difference between men's briefs and men's boxers. In other words, the latest iteration was more in the briefs dimension, in that it was very contoured. It was a very form-fitting type of device, as it were, which meant that some of the advanced screening technology that over the past 2 years has been brought online in the United States and elsewhere may not have been able to detect it. And I have to say, too, this is just the latest innovation. Even beyond that, we know that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is going beyond form-fitting bombs and seriously discussing the possibility of what the U.S. government now describes as SIIEDs, which means surgically implanted improvised explosive device. In other words, a bomb that is actually surgically implanted in a human being.
And you couldn't tell from the substance itself that it was there under the skin?
No, the substance itself is basically it's plastic explosive. And one of the benefits of plastic explosive is that it's highly malleable. It's very difficult to detect. It can be shaped into a number of different forms, even into form-fitting forms. But I think the main innovation of this particular device is that it had absolutely no metal components, which meant that it wouldn't be detected through metal detectors, and it was so form-fitting that the scanners would not have picked it up either.
And is there good reason to believe that it could have been detonated had the person been able to get on a plane?
Yes, I think we'll learn more about this because, of course, the FBI has the exact device and is examining it. But yes, it seems that the master bomb maker of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, a man named Ibrahim Hassan al-Asiri, studied very much the failure of the Christmas Day bomber in December 2009 and adopted a different means of detonation that he believes this time around would have been successful. And indeed, from what we hear from the authorities, they put some credence in that.
Obviously, there's a lot of information apparently came from this double agent, this embedded agent, about who the bomb makers are, and efforts are being made to find them and dispose of them. Is that a better way? Obviously, it seemed to me it would be a better way of dealing with this than having no-fly lists maintained by the FBI.
Well, I think you have to have multi-layered security. I don't think we can do away with the no-fly list. I think certainly from what I've heard on the program is that there has to be a greater rationality and a more transparent process of redress. And I think that's the fundamental issue with security measures is there has to be the oversight always, and there has to be the means of people who are innocent from being able to demonstrate their innocence. So it's not so much the no-fly list, I think, is a problem, is how it's administered. And these, again, I think, are subjects that the U.S. government is trying to redress. But the problem is, of course, as the underwear bomber demonstrates, you know, we're constantly having to catch up with the latest terrorist threat or the newest terrorist innovation. So it's an ongoing process.
Paul Rosenzweig, back to you, formerly with the recent Bush administration, the Department of Homeland Security, now with the Heritage Foundation Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. You said earlier that you thought it was very likely that a mistake had been made in the case of Abe Mishal, our first guest. Do you think that the FBI, the TSA, and others involved in this ought to take another look at the way they administer the program?
Well, I think we're constantly trying to improve the process. There's no doubt that when it was first created, the terrorist screening database was overpopulated with people and a whole host of mistaken identity cases. The famous Teddy Kennedy case and John Lewis. Over the course of
John Lewis, the congressman from Georgia.
John Lewis, the civil rights congressman. Yeah, and over the course of 5-7 years, the TSC has undergone a massive audit and validation process that is designed to eliminate the false positives. Another problem was that for a number of years, the actual name matching was done not by the TSA, but by the airlines themselves, and the airlines did it with varying degrees of fidelity and accuracy and effort.
So
they've changed that now.
Excuse me for interrupting you. The point, obviously, is that changes are being made. This is an evolutionary process, but we're running out of time, and I want to go back to Abe Mishal one more time. Given what we heard from Bruce Hoffman and what we've learned about the danger of the potential, or the potential danger, I should say, of this kind of technology, are you willing to suspend your civil rights in the concern of that, or out of those concerns, or do you think your case is still as solid as ever?
No, I mean, I would never give up my rights for security. I mean, Benjamin Franklin said those who sacrifice security for freedom deserve neither. I'm right on that same page. I'm not stopping them from doing the right thing, but, you know, I've been stuck on this list for over 2 years now, and how long does it take them to give me my life back? I mean, you know, and how many more Americans are going to go through this? And the point that he brought up is that they're constantly changing it, but there's still a lot of false positives. My gunnery sergeant, he's 6'2", African-American. He's on one of the lists because his name matches one of the heads of the Ku Klux Klan. It makes no sense. He's 6'3", an African-American.
How did he find out that it was because his name matched the Ku Klux Klan leader?
He looked it up online, and he found out a bunch of information online, and he was able to verify that information, too, by talking to somebody. But, I mean, it just makes no sense in having these lists. Of course, you know, they're always going to be able to say, well, you know, it's for your security. And I agree, there has to be some security. But in this day and age where we can do so many different things with technology, why is it so difficult to get this right?
All right. Abe Mashal, again, author of No Spy, No Fly, former Marine on the no-fly list. Paul Rosenzweig, formerly with the Department of Homeland Security, now with the Heritage Foundation Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. Bruce Hoffman, distinguished fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center, a director of the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University, and Hina Shumsi at the ACLU. Thank you all very much for being on our program. Sorry we don't have more time, but we'll come back to this on future programs. Great to have you all. Rebecca Brooks, her husband, and former aides say they are outraged by criminal charges filed against them today in connection with phone hacking and government corruption. We'll have more on the former chief executive of Rupert Murdoch's News International in a moment on To the Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_KCRW.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Rebecca Brooks was one of Rupert Murdoch's top executives and closest confidants, but the Crown Prosecution Service, known as the CPS, says she conspired to pervert the course of justice along with others. Here's her response, or part of it.
I cannot express my anger enough that those closest to me have been dragged into this unfairly.
They would include her husband and other aides, including her former chauffeur. Ben Fenton is chief media correspondent for the Financial Times. Good to have you on our program.
Hi.
Tell us a little more about exactly what she and her cohorts have been charged with.
They've been charged with 3 counts of perverting the course of justice, which is a common law offense. It's not actually in any particular statute. It's just sort of deemed to be a thing you don't do. Allegations that they tried to hide, electronic equipment, including a laptop computer and a mobile phone, from the police. There's an allegation that they removed 7 boxes of documents from Mrs. Brooks's office in the headquarters of News International, which your listeners may know is the UK newspaper arm of News Corp. And the third offence is a more general one of obstructing the police and trying to hide evidence from them.
Are these regarded as important charges in and of themselves, or are they the kind of charge that causes you to, testify and hope for working out a deal?
Well, we don't quite operate the same system as in the States. In theory, prosecution doesn't do deals in the UK. It does actually probably happen in practice, but in theory, it doesn't work like that here. I think these are serious cases. I mean, you can judge that from the fact that the maximum sentence for perverting the course of justice is life imprisonment in the UK, and we don't have a tougher sentence than that. It wouldn't happen. Nobody would ever get sentenced to life for it. But it's a measure of the fact that we believe that the judicial system is so important that you have to be able to give out very powerful punishments to people who attempt to pervert it.
So what are the implications, do you think, for Mr. Murdoch and others in his empire?
Well, these are charges which have sort of very much personal to Mrs. Brooks's alleged conduct. So, I mean, they're not, as yet, there's nothing that looks like touching Mr. Murdoch or his family. But it has to be said that anything that bears on Mrs. Brooks, who was a senior executive in his company, will raise questions about the conduct of the company generally. And one of the things that we're beginning, I think, to move towards in this whole thing, which seems to have been going on for years now, is the possibility of some sort of corporate charges against News International or against its subsidiary that owned the News of the World newspaper that got involved in this phone hacking thing in the beginning, which, if you can remember, that's where it all started, with people intercepting other people's voicemails on their cell phones.
What about the political implications? Mrs. Brooks has made it clear that she was very close to the current Prime Minister, David Cameron, and the former Prime Minister, Tony Blair.
Absolutely, and not only that, but her husband, Charlie, was at school with Mr. Cameron at Eton College, which is probably the most famous of our British public schools, private schools you'd call them in the States. Although they weren't contemporaries, they were supposedly friends. They live close to Mr. Cameron in the countryside, about 60-odd miles northwest of London, and they are friends of theirs. So it's very embarrassing for Mr. Cameron to have a personal friend facing criminal charges. So there's a political aspect to that too. But frankly, in terms of the political fallout from this whole affair, I don't think we've really started yet.
What about the people whose phones were hacked? They seem to have sort of gotten lost in all of the charges.
Well, what's happened to them is that most of them are a fair bit wealthier than they were before. There have been 60 cases settled so far with various people. Some of them are famous people like the actor Hugh Grant. Some of them are less famous people who just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and had their phones hacked by the News of the World. And they've received settlements which you wouldn't probably in the States regard as being particularly rich, but then they're not bad going for the UK. They're in the region of between about $35,000 and about $350,000.
Ben Fenton, chief media correspondent for the Financial Times. Sorry we had such a short time. Thanks a lot for joining us.
No problem.
Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl with Sonia Geis and Anna Scott. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point. Produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Hello again, Warren Alney. Next time on To The Point, shareholders may have forgiven CEO Jamie Dimon, but the FBI is looking into that $2 billion trading loss at J.P. Morgan Chase. Is it time for regulators to take action? Next time on To The Point from Public Radio International.